Okay. What do you remember from last week, or what questions do you have from last week? So, what stands out to you?
At the end of, you're going to have to help me a little bit. You were talking about, or the question was brought up about different languages, different religions, different cultures, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Why did God make us different?
Mm-hmm. Why did he allow that to happen? I think somebody was saying, so we're not these robots who all just
right.
believe the same thing. And we were talking about the Tower of Babel being a great, example of that. So they're all mm-hmm. trying to prove that, oh, we're, we're smarter than God. We'll build this giant tower and, mm-hmm. Get up to where he is. And what does he do? He mixes them all up so they can't understand one another, and then they're displaced.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that similar to, do you remember the end? I'm trying to,
So your point of view was to get a clearer picture of God by interacting with somebody from a completely different culture who experiences God differently.
Mm-hmm.
That makes your picture different.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to figure out how that relates to the story of the Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
Because
right. Right. Yeah, the Tower of Babel is very interesting for several reasons. there's handouts in the back if you would like them. There's handouts in the back over there. The Tower of Babel is a very interesting in the whole history of redemption and what God is doing. Because it reveals, it's Genesis 10 and 11. In Genesis 10 and 11, you have the Tower of Babel, and you also have the creation of all the nations. So God created all the ethnic groups. And if we didn't know any better, if that's all we had, it looks like it's almost in response to their sin. But by the time we get to Revelation, at least five times, it says every tribe, nation, people, and language is present in eternity. So that tells us it was God's plan all along. So the Tower of Babel represents one of those many, many examples where people's sinfulness, God turns it into his plan. He fulfills it. So they decided to group together. They didn't want to spread out because the last thing he had said, he said it to Adam and Eve, right? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. We typically think of giving birth to children. That's what we think of with multiplication, right? By the way, if you don't have four kids, you're not really obeying the Bible. Just thought I'd pass that on to you. Yeah, because one is subtracting, two is replacing, three is addition. You don't get the multiplication to four.
Sure it is. It's multiplying by 1.5.
He says that to Adam and Eve, and then after the flood to Noah, he says, be fruitful and fill the earth. Spread out on the earth and fill it and multiply. Right after that is the Tower of Babel. They say, nope. They all stick together. So God confounds the language is what happens. He creates all the languages in the ethnic groups, and they spread them out. And it looks almost like punishment, but it's not. It's really the grace of the Lord to step into sinful people and make sure it happens. And so he creates the ethnic groups by doing that. Different nations, different ethnicities, that sort of thing. From a theological perspective, there's only one human race. So we don't think in terms of racism the way sociologists use it, although it's very valuable to understand their language. But we think of one human race from the darkest to the lightest, made up of different ethnic groups within that category. Whenever I travel overseas, it's very interesting because I'm usually the only white guy in Africa or in Nepal. So one of the things I do is I tell the class, pick the darkest person in the class and have them come up here. Well, that's like racial. That's prejudicial. It's the same thing as if I say in our class here, if we have a mixed group, who's the darkest person, the blackest person here? You'd all get really kind of nervous, right? Well, they're no different. Even though their shades of dark are much closer than ours, we have a much wider spread. So they end up, I said, no, just do it. Pick the darkest guy. He comes up here and I say, you and I have something in common. We're the two bookends. Stand on either side of this room. Now the rest of you line up from darkest to lightest. And they have to start comparing colors to see who's darker. It's hilarious to watch them. And they line up, and then I can illustrate for them. All right, we have Tibetans in the class because we're in Nepal. We have Nepalese, we have Indian, we have Caucasian American. And we line up from darkest to lightest, and you can see we're all one human race. That's the way God made us. The reason for the ethnicities is so that we can grasp who He is much more clearly. If all I know about God is my viewpoint, it's wrong. I'm not God. And I just don't know enough to really know. But the moment I listen to Jason, he's a Caucasian male, and I begin to, well, he's too young. The moment I listen to Chris, he's more my age. And we have, you know, we probably grew up similar compared to everybody else in the room, similarly. But even still, when I listen to Chris talk about his relationship with the Lord, his experience with the Lord, he has nuanced that experience through his view of the Lord through that experience. My view of God begins to broaden. I go, oh, wow, I hadn't thought of that. Well, then I start listening to, you know, I talk to any of the women in here, and my view of God now has crossed gender lines, and I begin to hear different language. I just finished reading a book it was a published doctoral dissertation where they reviewed the women of the 19th century in America and Britain, and they reviewed the women who published and taught and their view of Scripture. And it's interesting because the author highlighted how different men and women see things. So, for example, the Samaritan woman at the well, the men tended to highlight, which is still true, the promiscuity, she's had five husbands, all of that. The women tended to highlight the fact that she went back and spoke publicly to the entire village, and the village came to know Christ. And here's an example of a woman preaching. All right? Two different views of the same story. So it's fascinating reading to see that. So I start talking to women, and my view of God broadens even more. Then I travel over to Nepal, where I cross every boundary there is, religion, socioeconomic, you know, ethnicity, all of that. And I listen to their view of God, and it's still very different than what I've even conceived of. You know, they were raised in a country with 330 million gods. The thought of only having one God is like, oh, it's wonderful. I only have to serve one, and He loves me. I don't have to worry about all the other gods and who's going to be angry with me. They have a whole different perspective. So when you start considering listening to all the ethnic groups, then your view of God gets even bigger and more accurate. So God cannot be fully known. I think He created His world this way. God cannot be fully known until both genders and every ethnic group is heard from. And that's what eternity will be about, is we get to share for all of eternity our relationship with the Lord and hear in different language, different concepts. Nepalese is different than Indian, which is different than American English, which is different than British English. Greek New Testament is different than Hebrew Old Testament. And so they both are talking about the same God, but from two, Hebrew and Greek, two different approaches in language. One's very pictorial, lots of imagery and pictures in Hebrew, and Greek is very linear and precise. And so the different languages help us capture that as well. So that's kind of a expanded summary. By the way, when you move into the New Testament, I think most of you know my theology, the Old Testament gives us a picture, a tangible picture to help us explain true spiritual reality in the New Testament. So when we look at we are the spiritual temple, we go back to the Jewish temple to define that, to define what our reality looks like in Christ today. Because we live our lives in two dimensions, two worlds, two spheres at the same time. I'm seated at the right hand of Christ right now, Ephesians 2. I don't know how that works because I'm sitting here with you. But apparently I'm in two places at the same time. So we have to go back, and we're told to fight the battle and live our faith out in both of those contexts. But the other context, we can't see it, the spiritual realm. We don't know what that looks like. So when He says we're the spiritual temple, we go back to the Jewish temple, and we say, okay, let's look at the Jewish temple and let's define it. What does that mean? What happened at the Jewish temple? This is where people could come and have their lawsuits and their differences resolved. because the priests would help resolve in the context of truth. Now over here, when the world looks at us, do they see us resolving our issues, or do they see us fighting? In the Jewish temple, this is where the priests could come, I mean, the poor people could come have their needs met. When the world looks at us today as a spiritual temple, the church, do they see us caring for the poor? This is where all the great Jewish festivals occurred, the dancing. The festivals lasted, some of them lasted 8 or 9 days. And the rabbis tell us that the singing and dancing went 24 hours a day for 8 days. I mean, think of the temple of the festival of booths, 8 days. So when the world looks at us, do they see us dancing and celebrating, or do they see us, you know, fighting, squabbling, grumbling, complaining? What do they see? So we look at the Jewish temple, and we look at the function of that temple, and that describes what we are to be like today. So you understand the kind of the tangible reality portrayed in the Old Testament. That helps us understand the language, because all the language of the Old reappears in the New, but now we can make sense of it. Well, the Tower of Babel is one of those that we have correspondences between the Old and the New. Because he says, spread out on the earth, be fruitful, multiply, spread out on the earth. They didn't do it. So he confused their language, created all the languages so they couldn't understand each other. And then it says he scattered them. Okay, now you move forward to Matthew 28, the end of Matthew, when Christ is about to ascend. What does he say? Go and make disciples of all the nations. Sounds an awful lot like, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Same idea, right? What do? They gather in Jerusalem for a year, and so God scatters them. In the Greek Old Testament, the word for scattered in the Tower of Babel is the same as the word for a scattering in Acts 8:1. Here, he confused the language by creating them. Here, he didn't eliminate linguistic separation. He brought in the spiritual gift of tongues so they could understand each other within their own language. So I actually wonder if that gift will be present in eternity, so we can understand each other. They're astounded because they see Peter up there preaching and they're hearing it in Cappadocian. And they're going, he doesn't speak Cappadocian, but that's what they're hearing, according to Acts. So the main elements of the story are present here in the New Testament. And that helps us understand what God actually meant by be fruitful, fill the earth, multiply, was reproduction. We tell each other about the Lord, this one true God. So now as it moves into the New Testament, it begins to expand and be fleshed out, in that Paul eventually says, we are the ones who display God's glory to the broken world. There's no billboard, flashing lights. There's no airplane with a banner behind it. It's us. We're the ones that reveal his glory to the Lord. And that's what his original intent was, to Adam and Eve and to Noah and at the Tower of Babel. So I don't know if that makes sense or not, but you can see the correspondences and make more theological sense of it. Thoughts? Questions? You're always allowed to throw tomatoes, but no rocks. What else do you remember from last week? We talked about prolegomena, the introduction to theology, and talked about faith. Right? Why is theology important? What is it? It's okay, you don't have to have my answer. I just want to know what you think. What's theology?
A deeper understanding of God is what I think.
Okay. Deeper understanding of God?
Mm-hmm. Personal enrichment.
Yeah. It's a compound word, comes from the word for God, theos, and the verb legeo, to speak about God or to have a conversation. In order to speak, you have to be with somebody. Otherwise, you're talking to yourself. It's a conversation about God. And so here we are having a conversation about God. And this is one of the primary ways that our knowledge of God grows, is by talking about him. And that's theology. Theology at its finest. Tonight we're going to talk about God himself. That's the next chapter in McGrath. So I have several questions we're going to, like I do every week, we're going to talk about. The first one is, how can we know God, or is he approachable and even knowable? not every religion believes that their God is knowable and approachable, but we do. In order to understand who God is, it's helpful because this is how he revealed himself. It's helpful to understand the context in which he revealed himself, because that kind of sets the parameters for who God is. God's revelation of himself took place in the context of polytheism, which is the belief in many gods, and pantheism, God is in everything. So both of those were very predominant in the ancient Near East. So a tree could be God, and God is in a tree. The sun can be God, and God is in the sun. And so almost all of the things of creation that we see today in the ancient world were considered a god.
That's called pantheism?
Yeah, polytheism is many gods. Pantheism is God is in everything. Okay? So that was a prevailing view. I mean, if you stare at the mountains, you have to admit they're pretty rugged and powerful, aren't they? You know, a hurricane comes out of nowhere, and you could envision, if you didn't know the truth, there's something, someone there. And so in the midst of a polytheistic and pantheistic world, he decided to reveal himself. So we learn a lot about God when we compare ourselves with the ancient view of the gods, because he distinguishes himself every step of the way. The story of creation occurred in 1500 BC, Genesis 1 and 2 roughly, when they were just out of Egypt. He had just led them out of Egypt. They're basically a band of slaves. They knew nothing about foreign policy, military strategy, governance. They didn't know any of that stuff. They were slaves. They were cared for. And so you have this ragtag group of slaves standing out in the desert with no knowledge of how to be a nation. Most likely, they were more Egyptian in their theology than they were Jewish, because the Bible hadn't been written yet. So they had passed down some of the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and God's discussion with them, but the law hadn't been given, the Ten Commandments hadn't been given, any of those things had not been given. So there, you picture just a bunch of slaves standing there, and they're used to being taken care of by Egyptians. And Moses, this is what makes Moses so unique, by deciding to give Moses away to be raised in the royal court of Pharaoh, that ensured that he was raised in the finest traditions of the land in all of those categories, because every son of Pharaoh was trained to be a leader, everyone. So he would have been raised in military strategy. He would have been trained in economics. He would have been trained in foreign and domestic policy. He would have been trained in all of those things. And so the very act of killing all of the male babies was in itself the vehicle that God used to ensure that Moses would be raised with all of the training to be a true politician, to be a true leader and a general. So he's the one person that knows how to lead the nation. Okay? And so they're standing out at the base of Mount Sinai, 3 months out of Egypt, and God, the first thing God gives them is the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments revolutionized the world. For example, thou shalt not murder. When God gave that commandment, he introduced and gave as a gift to the world the discussion of murder from a moral perspective. I don't know of any evidence prior to the Ten Commandments being given where we discuss murder from a moral perspective. We discuss it from a practical perspective. So we're all in the same little village here, and I go and kill Jason. Well, Shane and I aren't going to be getting along very well because we are right here in the same little village. So we made a rule, let's don't kill anybody here, but we had no compunction about crossing the valley and killing the people over there. It wasn't a moral issue. It was a practical issue. So the introduction of that one command changed world history because morality was introduced. Or as C.S. Lewis argued, we all have a spiritual compass. It's just broken. We're looking for what is right and wrong, but we can't figure it out because we can't find true north. When God speaks, zing, true north is now highlighted. So the Bible is the record of God bringing morality to the world through the Jewish people and then through the church later on. That's just one example of it. So they're standing there. He gives them the Ten Commandments. Here's the basic framework of which with which society should live and get along together. We shouldn't be stealing each other's property, including wives and animals and axes and trucks or whatever. We just shouldn't do that. We're not going to get along as a people group. So the Ten Commandments provide the basic framework for how society functions today. The other commands are all replaceable.
Why was Cain held accountable for killing Abel if the command to murder had not been given, to not murder had not been given yet?
God still holds you accountable. It's a great question, but God still holds you.
That he hasn't revealed yet.
Right. And God had revealed to Cain before he killed them, be careful. Sin is crouching at the door. I know what you're about to do. You know, if you have faith, and the real issue, according to Hebrews, was an issue of faith, even more than murder. All right? If you have faith, your offering will be accepted just like your brother's. So Hebrews makes it clear that one of the brothers offered their sacrifice in faith and the other one didn't. So God confronted him before it happened, which confirms Paul's statement that how would we know it's sin if God did not reveal it? Which, by the way, makes God at some level complicit in the garden. Because if he had never said, don't eat that fruit, it would have never been sin. And so that's part of his plan to reveal not to eat of this fruit. That makes it sin if you do, and we did. And so he warns Cain before Cain takes a step.
So does God choose, maybe choose isn't the right word. Is God the one who chooses what sin is and what sin isn't? Or does the concept of what sin is and is not, is that separate from God and he reveals it to us?
I'd say yes and yes.
We're in a theology class. I forgot.
It's very akin to philosophy. Yeah, what is sin is what God reveals as sin. Okay? You bet. There's a peanut gallery back there.
Yeah.
So they're standing there, and God decides, the very first thing he tells them after the Ten Commandments is, let me tell you about the creation story. That precedes the Mosaic Law. Let me tell you about the creation story. So it's very intriguing that that's the first piece of information he gives them. Because in order to understand who God is, you have to understand who he is in the context of the world, his creation. He is distinctly different from his creation. He is not part of it. He oversees it. He is not found in anything except us when the Holy Spirit indwells us. But that's not pantheism because he maintains his distinctive spirit different from ours while he indwells us. And so he is not part of creation. He stands outside of it in every way that you can measure. So the first thing he did was begin to define who he is, but in the context of the worldview of creation. And he began to compare himself against the other gods. So our responsibility is to identify the God in which we believe. He is not one God among many. He is the only God. So you'll hear me say from the pulpit often, I believe in the one true living God. That's my statement. That's my affirmation of faith. I believe in the one true living God. From John 1:18, we learn, it's a very significant passage about God. We learn three things about God. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made himself known. So he is the only God, only begotten Son, the Son is, that's the old term, okay, who is himself God. He is God. He is himself God and is in close relationship with the Father. So he's distinctly different from, but yet he is God at the same time. We'll get to the Trinity later on in the class. Not tonight, but later on in a few weeks. And he was the one who reveals God. So no one has ever seen God. Jesus always reveals him. Now, this is what's called a controlling verse. This makes sense forward and backward of all the passages where we seem to see God. So the technical language that we use, because theologians love to come up with technical language to describe things, is when God appears in human form, that is a Christophany. It's Christ. When he appears in supernatural form through creation like the burning bush, that's a theophany. It's God revealing himself through creation in a supernatural way. So when he appears as a human, that's Jesus. Okay? So the great story of Isaiah 6, where King Uzziah is standing in the throne room of God, and he says, wow, all of a sudden he's transported in the throne room, and he said, I see the Lord sitting on a throne, and he uses the capital L-O-R-D, so he uses a divine name. I see Yahweh sitting on the throne. His robe is filling the temple and all these animals and these creatures and this smoke and all this stuff, and God speaks to him. In John chapter 12, I think it is, John says, he quotes that, and he said he saw Jesus. That's who he saw. And so whenever you see God appearing in the form of a human, that's Christ. If it's before Christ's birth, we call that, because we like technical terms, a Christophany or a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. But it's always Jesus. It's always Jesus. So John 1:18 helps us understand that Jesus, who is himself God, is the one that always reveals God to us. There's no other way. What about what we know about God comes through revelation. There are two types of revelation, general and specific. Paul argues very powerfully that general revelation is what we see all around us in creation. There is enough information to help us come to the conclusion that there is someone bigger than us. That's all it can do. It can't get us any more precise than that. There's someone bigger than us out there. Now we have a choice, and he argues in Romans 1 that what we do with that choice is that we turn away from God. We create carved images, we have idols and gods all over the place, and we reject that because we don't really want to serve a true God. And so we find ways of getting around it. But then throughout the Bible at various places, those people that respond to God, God says, if you search for me, I will be found by you. In Hebrew, it's a very great picture of someone just planting themselves in the road. So you're in the road coming this way, you got to run into me. So that's how God pictures himself. If you're looking for me, you will find me. So we tend to think from our side of eternity, our side of heaven, that it's a statistical game. People have a higher probability of coming to Christ in our culture than they do in, say, in Nepal, where only 1% of the people are Christian. The rest are Hindus, Buddhists, and Muslims. And so we tend to think we have a greater probability. It's not true. Every human has the basic knowledge they need to make a decision and pursue God. And God says, when you pursue me, I'm going to be right there. You won't miss me. So every human around the planet is without excuse. That's the word that Paul uses. They are without excuse. So that's the heart of the gospel. God cares about every human alive. And God's not going to let any human miss him. It's not going to happen. In fact, my theology, after all the years of studying, is every human, I can say three things about every human. One is, God loves them more than I do. Number two, God has been pursuing them much longer than I have, if I have the chance. And number three, he has a lot more experience with that type of person than I do. He is pursuing every human. That is the heart of the gospel. And so we have often framed the gospel in terms of, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're condemned to hell. But it may be more accurate theologically to reverse the decision and say, salvation is yours to lose because God made you to pursue him, and you chose not to do that. So you made the choice to reject God for a variety of other things, whatever they are. Does that make sense? Can I describe it that way? So there's no better probability in our country than any other country in the world. We have examples from all over the world of God, God making himself known when they sought him. I was one of my students in Nepal Some of you heard the story a couple years ago. She just graduated. But I asked her, what's your story? And she said she was a junior in high school and she's Hindu, raised in a Hindu family in a Hindu village, far away from any Christian mission. No, never even heard of Christians. And but she's pondering, how do you know all this is true? She turns her radio on, and she hears a presentation of the gospel. She accepts Jesus. She couldn't tell her family, so she writes a letter to this mission group. They're across into another country, broadcasting into Nepal. And so she writes them, and they send her the Gospel of John and some literature, and that's all she had for 2 years. She read it over and over and over again, and she was praying. So she graduates from high school. She sits down with her parents, and she said, I heard a radio broadcast about Jesus, and I believed in him. Her dad didn't say a word. He gets up, grabs her by the arm, walks to the front door, throws her out, closes the door, and locks it. Doesn't even let her go to her room to get her wallet, her money, her ID, or anything. No clothes. And she banged on the door, and, Dad. And he says, you no longer are alive to me. You're no longer part of my family. You're not welcome. So she sits down on the front steps and starts to cry. And she just said, Lord, I don't know who to talk to. I don't know where to go. I don't know any Christians. I don't know how to take care of myself. I don't have any idea or money or anything. So she starts wandering down the middle of the village, a dirt road, and she gets down near the end, and her older sisters, one of his friends, comes walking around the house, and she always liked him, not romantically, he was just a nice guy. And he sees her crying, and he says, what's the matter? And she said, I became a Christian, and I just told my parents, and they just kicked me out. And he just smiled, and he said, come with me, I'm a Christian. And took her to a family that took her in, fed her, clothed her, helped her restore her identity and her money and all that. Now, that was in June. In August, I'm talking to her for the first time. She's a brand new student. I said, what are you doing here? She says, nobody in my village has ever heard about Christ, and I want to learn as much as I can so I can go back and tell my family and my friends about Christ. All right. You can't attach probability to that. She was wrestling with the truth, turned on the radio at the right second, and there it is. Boom. Somebody's talking about the Lord. So every person has the same opportunity around the world. So God reveals himself through his revelation. The general revelation is enough to get people to the point where they say, who are you? Then specific revelation is when God speaks directly, and that's what we find in the Bible. Right there. Specific revelation. Additionally, God reveals himself through examples, analogies, which gives us a very limited perspective of God. It's because we can never fully understand God. If we could, we would be God. And that's all of eternity is the pursuit of God, and we'll never get there. But if you think about it, that makes sense. If you think about your best friend, right? As the years go by, you never really get to the end of who your best friend is. You know them more and more, and they become more familiar to you, more comfortable, but you're still surprised by them. You're still learning things about them. The relationship gets deeper and deeper, but you never reach the end. So we live with that all the time in our world. It's especially true between husband and wife. I have no idea what planet Nancy came from, but it's not mine.
She told me to scold you if you talk about her tonight.
Uh-huh.
Remember, she can listen to
this. Oh, my goodness, she can. Yeah, I think I told some of you this story, but I'll tell you again. I was teaching a doctoral class last summer at Denver Seminary, and at the last day of the class, we all went out to lunch, and so we're all sitting around a big table, and next to me is this young, attractive, very bright doctoral student. She's a mom with 2 or 3 young kids, and she says, so tell me about your wife. And I said, oh, there's a tragic, tragic story. And she said, why? All the other students started to get quiet. I said, well, she has a severe mental condition. We've been married 32 years, and I've tried for 32 years to find somebody qualified to help her, and I can't. And, of course, she's a mom, so she goes, I'm so sorry, like that. And She says, if it's not too personal, can you tell me what's wrong? And I said, yeah, she's a woman. Yeah, I just, she goes, bang, with her elbow, just about broke my ribs. It was great. She goes, I don't even know your wife, and I like her. I do too. I don't understand her, but I like her. All right, second question, who is God? Or what analogies or examples do we use, does he give us to understand himself? He calls himself a shepherd. Now, no analogy is perfect, but the main thrust of the analogy helps us capture a glimpse of who he is. He's a shepherd. That means he loves and cares for the sheep. He also guides the sheep. It reveals something about us in that sheep are incapable of taking care of themselves, so we're dependent on him. So the imagery of shepherd automatically begins to introduce a healthy dependent relationship with God. He's called a father. In this regard, he's a creator. So Jesus referred to the Father as Lord of heaven and earth. When you look at all the church councils, they got this idea from the creeds that surface in here, Colossians 1 and others. They always start with God as creator. That's where he started. He started with himself as creation. So what's the Apostles' Creed? Right? Got it in the beginning of your book. We believe in what?
God the Father.
God the Father. What comes next? Creator of heaven and earth. Right. And that's the way it always starts. So we tend to start with the individual, move to the church, maybe get back to creation. But the pattern all throughout the New Testament is to start with God as creator. And all the creeds follow that, the church creeds. That's the way it's best to unfold God in the lives of people. God is the one who made all this. So I've been meeting with a young man. He's 24, not a Christian. He's not here right now, but for the last couple of years, we've had gotten together for coffee. And he got in a lot of trouble with the law, was in prison. And while he was in prison, he had to go to counseling, committed a felony, a pretty serious one. And the counselor suggested that he should figure out what his view of God is. So he gets here, and he was pretty depressed. And somebody gave him my name on a piece of paper. I don't even know who it was. Said, this guy will spend time with you and help you. So he calls me up and said, would you meet with me? I go, yeah, you bet. So we met, and we're at the coffee shop. And we're actually, the first time he comes into my office, and he said, yeah, the counselor in jail in the federal prison said that I should figure out my view of God. He said, can you believe that? View of God? Does anybody believe in God? Now, the irony of the whole thing is he's sitting surrounded by 2,000 books, all but about two of them are about God. He doesn't even know that. And I go, well, yeah, I actually believe in God. And so we've been talking, and he said, you believe in God? And I said, yeah. And he goes, really? Well, is this like karma? And I said, well, if there was a God, would you want him to believe in karma? And he said, no. And I said, yeah, my God doesn't believe in karma. And he said, well, huh. How do I find this God? What do I have to do? Nothing. You don't have to do anything. He'll find you. He said, he'll find me? I said, yeah. He goes, cool. Just like that. And I said, the truth is, he has already found you, or you wouldn't be sitting here. So I said, if you would like to spend time together, I can tell you about him, because I know him well. And he said, I'd like that. So we go over to Red Buffalo Coffee Shop, and he sits down, he says, okay, tell me something about your God. And I said, look out the window. So he turns his chair around, looks out the window. I said, you see all those mountains out there? Yeah. He said, he made those. He just stared for like 2 minutes. I just drank my coffee. He turns around and he goes, why would he do that? And I said, two reasons. One is so you would enjoy it. Do you enjoy it? And he goes, oh, I love it. I said, perfect. You're already fulfilling one of the reasons he made it. The second one is so he can teach you something about himself. And so when you're out in the creation, start asking yourself, who made all this? So the conversation is unfolding slowly over time. And that's where I started, with creation. Because that's something he can grasp, is creation. So he's the Father. He's the creator. He brought us into existence. He is the author of eternal life. He cares for us. He loves us. But that raises another question. Is he male? In your handout, I said, myth number one, God is not a male. But yet, the scriptures use masculine references to refer to God. This is consistent with the patriarchal culture, but we need to ask the question, why would God use gendered language, okay, to describe himself? Well, we are creatures who are created with gender, and our gender is inseparable from our existence. We don't know how to think except within the context of our gender. I'm a man, I think like a man. My wife is a woman, and she thinks like a woman. And we think and live and view the world within that context. So because we are created beings with gender, we have no other way to speak of a personal God except in a gendered way. So if I refer to God as it, it'd be very difficult for you to conceive of a personal God and have a relationship with a personal God. Does that make sense? God made us so that the only way we know how to describe personality and relationship is with gendered language. In other words, as creatures with gender, we can only understand a personal God using gendered language. But this doesn't mean that he is gendered. He is neither male nor female. He is beyond the technical languages. He is beyond sexual distinction. He fully encompasses all of masculine and feminine and more traits. Mm-hmm.
So would it be just as accurate to call God her as it would be to call, say, him?
Perhaps theologically, but I wouldn't do it because he never does it. Okay. So
is there a reason for that?
Well, Jesus does come as a man. We have to talk about that in a minute. So Jesus actually has gender, okay, when he takes on the form of male. So that is common in some circles to refer to God as he/she, okay? But that really confuses it. And even in today's world, it would confuse people to begin to call God she. It's not because he's a he. It's just because that's the kind of the direction he's identified with.
But if there were a Bible, for instance, that always had feminine pronouns,
mm-hmm.
Because that was easier for somebody to associate,
mm-hmm.
would that be accurate?
Possibly. The reason I believe he chose masculine language is because of the curse. The curse created a patriarchal society, not a matriarchal society. Now, that brings with it a whole ton of abuses, and I want to make sure you understand what I mean by patriarchal. Okay, it is a whole series of abuses, and I don't think it's God's ultimate plan. I think in eternity we will be equal in every respect, and if we can get there now, we should. But he communicates in the language that a fallen world can understand. Let me say it that way. Okay. But he is, the most important thing is he's neither male nor female. He's beyond sexual distinction. So the use of masculine and feminine language and metaphors is an accommodation to our createdness and our fallenness. But still, we have to use gendered language. That's what I want to get across. Because you can't understand God apart from gendered language. Not in a personal way. So the masculine and feminine metaphors used throughout the Bible are used because he is personal. Additionally, the use of masculine and feminine metaphors allow us to approach God and enter into a personal relationship with him in light of our own gender. Now, as gender takes on different language, different nuances, we have to be careful how we do it. For example, in our culture in the United States today, sexual abuse of women is over 30% nationally. In the millennial generation, it's about 50%. In other words, one out of two women in the millennial generation have been sexually abused. It's no difference between the church and the world. Same is true. I tried to get this point across to our elders and two or three years ago, and I used that statistic, and they all said, oh, okay. And I was kind of looking around waiting for tears, and there weren't any. So I said, come with me. Elders is on the same night as middle school. So I took them up to the middle school room. I said, how many girls do you see in there looking through the doors? And they said, 10. All right, let me say this again. 50% of the millennial generation has been sexually abused. And one of the elders said, yeah, but these are Christian girls. There's no difference. Statistics are the same in the church as out of the church. And one of them said, you mean five of those girls? I said, exactly. Then I saw the tears. Okay? So what that's done is that's raised up for us a conundrum. If I speak of God, as Father, then for those young women or women who have been mistreated sexually, that does not create a personal relationship. It creates anger and hostility. Right? Does that make sense? Which actually better fits within the context, because the language of father in the ancient world was not a personal idea. Fathers didn't know their children. First of all, they had many wives, often. Polygamy was very prevalent. And so the wives were responsible to raise the households and the family. The fathers went off, fought wars, raised crops. They did all that sort of stuff. Father was a term of identity. Think about how Paul uses it. Our father Abraham. He didn't know Abraham. Right? So father was more more language related to identity than it was related to personal daddy imagery. And so I think it's broad enough to allow that imagery, but it doesn't require it. And so when we're in a context where we're dealing with people who have been abused by a father, in whatever form the abuse takes, we need to remember that and be sensitive. That metaphor doesn't help very much in that context. We have to find another way to explain personality in a safe way with a God. Does that make sense?
How do you do that, though?
That's the tough thing. Everyone's different. I mean, there's no formula for how to do that. You know, part of it, when Nancy and I were in Germany, we read a book. We had a young lady that we thought, neither one of us are trained as counselors. My area is theology. She's an electrical engineer. And so we had a woman who was married, and they were really struggling in their marriage. Newlyweds, it was really troubling. So we started spending time with them, just to hang out with them. And it really became obvious to us that something was drastically wrong, tragically wrong. We didn't know what it was. We suspected it was abuse. And so we ordered books in the United States, and we read a whole bunch of books on victims of childhood sexual abuse to get a handle on what this looked like. And so we were able to kind of frame out the conditions of a typical person. What are the symptoms that reveal that? And she met 100% of them. So we began to move in that direction. And I asked her... and this is when I knew that she was in real trouble. I said, "So, tell me about growing up. What was it like growing up in your life?" And she said, "Well, you know, just normal." Okay, that's not the normal response you get. I go, "Oh, what color was your bedroom when you were a girl?" I don't know. Suppose it was pink. And as I started asking her questions, she couldn't remember anything. That is not normal. And then at some point she realized that. She said, "How come I can't remember that?" And I said, "I don't know that. But this is where grace comes in. You will." So we began praying together and talking. And what came out eventually was she was the youngest of five kids. She had been two boys, two girls, two brothers, two sisters, had been sexually abused violently by her father and all four siblings. All we did was love on her until she could get back to the States and get professional help. But what we did in the middle of that was I said, "All right, you don't really understand who God is as a personal God and Father, do you?" She says, "No, I don't have a clue." And I said, "Okay, well, here's what I want to do to help you. Here are, in our ministry, we have all these young soldiers. You know, there's 30 of them. Here are five of them that are safe. I want you to spend time with the five. With your permission, I would like to give them just a glimpse, not tell them the whole story, but just a little indication of what you're struggling with. And these are guys that are guys, and they're safe." And she said, "Okay." I said, "We need to begin redefining your concept of a male authority figure or a male figure in your life around safety." And that's what we did. I went to the five guys and just gave them just a glimpse of it. And they became very safe in her life. She could talk to them. I said, "The other guys, I don't know. But these five I trust." And so we started giving her, first of all, we never met with her one-on-one. It was always two of us with her. You know, so two guys would say, "Hey, you want to come with us? We're going to go down and get an ice cream cone." And she learned, she wouldn't do that at first, but she learned to say, "Okay, I'll go with you." And they would just laugh and joke with her and treat her with dignity and respect. And we had to begin redefining what the males in her life had taken away from her. That's a long process. By the way, they're still married. They got several kids now. And she still struggles with all of that. Redemption will be sweet to her when it comes. So there's one approach. It's all different how you do it. Now, the metaphors used in Scripture are predominantly masculine, but don't make the mistake assuming that's how the ancient Hebrews perceived of God. They didn't perceive of him in terms of predominantly masculine language. The Bible is moving towards breaking down those stereotypes. So you look, for example, in Isaiah 45, God is pictured as the husband of Israel. Now, he's never pictured as the wife, but he is portrayed as mother offspring, if you will, in several places in Isaiah. One who cares for her children. That language is used in Isaiah. The actual picture of the Spirit hovering over the surface of the water in Genesis 1 captures the idea. It's very similar to the language. That same wording is used in Deuteronomy 32, where God is portrayed as an eagle hovering over her young to protect them. And so right off the bat, God begins to break down stereotypes by using female imagery, not as prevalent as masculine imagery, but he begins to break down the stereotypes by describing himself in that language. Jesus used similar metaphor in Matthew 23 when he cast himself as a mother hen gathering her chicks. He looks at Jerusalem and like a mother hen gathers her chicks. So he uses that language. Paul catches on to that, and in 1 Thessalonians, he uses father imagery and mother imagery to describe his ministry. He is a father and he is a nursing mother, a gentle mother. So he uses both images to capture his ministry to the people. So the masculine and feminine metaphors used of God demonstrate a fundamental gender equivalence, I believe. And that he's breaking down the stereotypes that have arisen in a fallen patriarchal world. Okay? Gender references help us to grasp who God is without implying his gender. This is one of the unique distinctions of Christian theology. We don't find it anywhere else. Humans are gendered beings. God is not. In every other religion, the gods are gendered beings. But in our religion, they're not. He's not. He is simply accommodating himself to us. Neither male nor female sexuality is ever attributed to God. Sexuality is an attribute of creation, and God is distinctly different from creation. So it doesn't apply to him. Okay? The fact that he uses female metaphors to break the traditions shows me that all along his journey is to break that patriarchal grip that sin brought on the world. He does not meet any of our roles. He doesn't follow those. What is true about God is that he models our common humanity, not our gender identity, nor our gender roles. He borrows the roles as a metaphor to explain different facets of the way he relates to us. But he models our common humanity. So since God is beyond sexual difference, there's nothing in God that corresponds to the roles that we assume as male and female. In fact, one of the elders during the whole journey that we've been on as a church asks, well, how are gender roles defined? How would you answer that? How are gender roles defined? Who defines gender roles? Culture. Always. Between two separate cultures, you have two different definitions and expectations of what the gender roles are like. Within any one culture, they're changing constantly. So I mentioned to our older elders, you know, when we were young, could you ever conceive of a woman being CEO of a company? We all said no. I remember working for public service when they appointed the first female supervisor. We all thought it was going to be the end of the world. I remember when that happened. I remember Nancy telling me, we married 32 years ago, she's an electrical engineer, and she was in our church, and after about 6 months, she said, I don't think the women in our church really like me. They don't feel comfortable around me. And I said, what? Why is that? And she says, because I'm an engineer. I said, well, you got all these other women working. She says, yeah, but they're all teachers and nurses. I'm an engineer. So I began to explore that as a young elder, and she was dead on. That was not accepted. So within any one culture, the roles are being redefined steadily over time. So there is no constant on what... The only constant is, you can bear children and I can't, and I praise God for that. This means that the nature of God tells us nothing about what it means to be male or female. That's the conclusion. Nature of God tells us nothing about what it means to be male or female. Therefore, using God language for construction of gender, identity, and roles is illegitimate. It's inappropriate. That was the conclusion that our elders came to, and that was published in the document that we gave to the congregation. Our conclusion, using God language for construction of gender identity and roles is illegitimate. Because you can't trace any of it back to God. Now, let me just say a brief thing about Jesus. Jesus, true, is a male. No question about that. But Jesus never lived into, if I can put it this way, this is a very complex area of Christological discussion, but Jesus never lived into the masculinity, the maleness side of who he is. Never had, intimate relations with anybody, never did any of that. In other words, both males and female can look at Christ and see a picture of the perfect human. Don't think of him as a perfect man. He's the perfect human. That's why he uses the metaphor of gathering chicks and things like that for himself. So in that regard, he did not live as we do as males, living into that maleness. And he didn't struggle with the same things that we struggle with, I think, without a sin nature. So women can look at Jesus and see the perfect definition of a human just like males can, because what he modeled was perfect humanity. So we use the technical language right out of the Bible that we are being transformed into the image of Jesus, image of his son. What that means in lay language is that he is the perfect human and we're becoming better humans. As we move toward Christ, we become more human. We become more generous, more loving, more affectionate, more forgiving, on and on and on. And either gender can capture that by looking at God, looking at Jesus. He is the perfect. He represents God perfectly, and he represents humanity perfectly. When we get to studies on Jesus in a few weeks, I forget when it is, but we'll look at what's called the hypostatic union. Two natures united in one body. So the hypostatic union, two natures united in one body forever. He is a human forever. And that's part of his sacrifice. So we think of his sacrifice as what happened on the cross. That's legitimate. It's very powerful what happened on the cross. But the sacrifice is far more encompassing and comprehensive and complex than that. When he became a human for all time. So in Revelation, he's standing in the heavenly temple. He's in the New Jerusalem, and we can enjoy him. We can sit with him. We can, just like Peter did after he rose from the dead, we can eat with him. We can laugh and joke and talk with him. So we are created beings who are very uncomfortable without a body. He wasn't made to live in a body. So his sacrifice is eternal. Does that make sense? By adopting the human form? So what I want you to remember right now is that his sacrifice for us is an eternal sacrifice. From now on, he lives within a body and relies on the Father, just like we do. It's pretty amazing when you start probing some of the depths of that. We'll come back to that. Questions at this point? Yeah, it's really hard to define that because God doesn't exist within the context of time. Okay? So we can answer with human answers, but it's very weak at best. So I would say, no, at a point in time, if you look at Romans 1, okay, using temporal imagery, he begins to address a little bit of that language. I never forget when I read this because it was on my doctoral exam. Paul, servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, the gospel he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures regarding his son, who as to his earthly life was a descendant of David, and who through the spirit of holiness was appointed to be the Son of God in power. Okay, now think about what that means. He is always the second person of the Trinity, and he was appointed to be the Son of God. That's pretty technical and challenging language to figure out how that happened. Don't know the answers to that. So, just like we're never going to solve the mystery of the Trinity, all we can do is look at the evidence, I mean the text, and say, here's what the text says. We've got to believe it. We're never going to really understand it. How can he be omniscient and omnipresent and be in a body at the same time? I don't know that. But the Bible's pretty clear that happens. So in his pre-incarnate state, he appears as a human. I mean, he could do whatever he wants. I don't know how that happens. So what I'm trying to do is give you the language of the scripture to help you make sense of it. Because as God, we learn something about him, and as human, we learn something about him. So we'll come back to that when we study Christ, Christology. Other thoughts, questions?
Can you address, you're talking about how, you know, he has a body for all eternity, but he's not in a body anymore.
He is.
He's
in his resurrected body. So he ate fish with Peter, but it's a different kind of body. It's the same kind of body we'll have. He walked through walls, but he was still in a body. He ate fish. He ate with the disciples out on the beach. And the Revelation pictures him standing in the New Jerusalem with us. He's there with us. So he always, according to John 1:18, he always is revealing God to us. Because we can't see the Father. Because Moses asked, can I see you? And he said, no, you'll die. We can't do that. So he accommodated himself to us by taking on our form so that we could relate and we would have someone to talk to that is substance. Bizarre, huh? So most people think of a sacrifice, and right, this is not a criticism, this is appropriate, is what happened on the cross, but the sacrifice is far bigger than that. His sacrifice is eternal in nature. He is forever a human with us. And that's been the orthodox statement of the church since the beginning, since they figured that out. Fully God, fully human, united in one body for eternity. It's called the hypostatic union. Yeah. So, what that means is, God loves you so much, he adopted a human form so that you could connect with him. He accommodated himself to you. It's like a father gets down on the knees and starts playing with toys with a two-year-old. He becomes like a two-year-old. Or a mother. Father or a mother. And that's what Jesus did with us. For all of eternity. So, the picture is of the New Jerusalem, Revelation 21:22. The gates of the city are open. They're never closed. So that's a metaphor that heaven is the new Jerusalem, the new earth is a safe place. Because the only reason they close the gates at nighttime is for protection. If the gates are always open, then that means it's safe. No need to close them. Second thing is there's no sun or moon because the Lamb is the sun or moon. He makes it possible for us to see everything. I don't know what that means. But he's standing in the temple and we're conversing with him. The next image is that you have the kings and the nations going in and out of the city, bringing their glory to him. That tells us that that we're still doing the things we do today. We're making things and bringing it to him. We're showing him what we made. I mean, the whole reason he created us, we'll look at this when we talk about anthropology, is Genesis 1. Let us make humans in our image so that they can rule over the fish of the sea. They can rule over the earth. That's why he made us, is to work. And so work is not the problem for any of us. It's working in a sinful context that's the issue. We all like working and making things happen. And so on the new earth, we're constantly doing that. A friend of mine, a theologian at Denver Seminary, he likes to ask the question, when you smash your finger with a thumb, or you smash your thumb with a hammer, and it splits it and it starts to bleeding, then you watch it and the blood coagulates. The coagulative properties of blood, is that a product of the creation or the curse? What do you think?
Curse.
You think the curse? Yeah, I don't. I don't know if a theologian would say that. It's a product of creation.
Really?
Yeah. We're made to smash our fingers. That's how we learn. Yeah, I think so. Before Adam fell, he was working the garden.
What was he smashing his finger?
Probably getting blisters and all kinds of things. Yeah.
I don't know. I think you can make the argument that if there wasn't a curse, then working wouldn't produce the same blisters in the same way that it wouldn't produce the ones in thistles.
Yeah, that introduces the idea of what's called, this class isn't designed for this, but I'll just introduce the topic to you, what theologians call planned obsolescence in the creation. You can't plant something and watch it grow. If you think about the way we image heaven, everything is static. You can't plant something and watch it grow. So if, in fact, we were made to work, then that means we have to accomplish things. Things have to grow. And so, therefore, that introduces what theologians refer to as planned obsolescence. Things die. And so you plant new things. What we don't know is what dies. In Ezekiel, it says, at the end of Ezekiel, that in the new earth, if a human dies before reaching 1,000, that'll be a very shameful thing. Nobody knows what to do with that passage. So, trees grow, plants grow, they die, and they grow, and they reproduce, and they die, and they grow, and they reproduce, and they die. But the picture is that we are working. There's no indication that physiologically we changed at the curse. No indication in the Bible of that. What died was our spirit. So, something to ponder. Okay, next question. What is God like? In other words, is he personal? He is a God with whom we can exist in relationship, which is analogous to what we do with each other. We're created for a relationship. I had a coffee with a couple of wives in our church. I just love them to death. It was really a fun coffee. And they're reading a book on how they need to learn to trust God alone, right? And so I've learned long ago, when somebody says something that either feels like it's out to lunch or I don't know what to do with it, I just go, oh. So they said, so we're reading this book and we're trying to learn how to relate better to our husbands, and we're trying to learn that God is all we need. And I go, oh. So since God is all we need, we learn to need to rely on him. We don't really need our husbands. What we need is the Lord, dependence on the Lord. And I go, oh. So he went on and kept filling the void. Finally, one of them said, what do you think about that? And I said, well, let's say I'm your husband. And I come home one day and I say, I no longer need you. I've got the Lord. How are you going to feel? Terrible. And she said, terrible. And I go, throw the book in the trash. The moment God said it's not good for the man to be alone, he just revealed to us that he created us so that he's not enough. And so the woman, in the creation story, the woman becomes the most important part of the story because she is the divine agent that completes what is lacking in the male. That's how you think of it. The male is incomplete without the female. The female completes what is lacking. That's what the word helper means. It's popular in some more conservative circles to identify that helper implies some level of submission. The problem with that is that the word helper in Genesis 1, that's the only place it's used of a human. Every other place in the Bible is used of God, I believe. God says, I am the helper to Israel. Is he submissive to Israel? No, not at all. What that means is Israel can't do it on their own, and I am completing what they're lacking. That's why that term is used of the woman when he creates the woman. The woman completes the man, completes what is lacking. And so together in relationship, not only in marriage, but in just relationships in general, we do better when we work together and listen to each other. This was one of the arguments that the elders eventually got to in our question of the role of women in our church, was that we have all these strata of leadership where men and women are working together. Everywhere we look, youth advisory board, the children's advisory board, the worship team, the missions committee, except for elders. Elders is the one strata of leadership where the women aren't involved. And that was one of their conclusions that needs to change. Once we recognize what's theologically what's happening here. So God exists in relationship with us, analogous to the relationship we have with each other. Okay. He is described in terms of personal attributes. So there are two types of attributes, what they call communicable and incommunicable. Communicable ones are the ones that we embody ourselves. Love, for example. We're learning what it means to be loving. So the communicable attributes of God, we are adopting and growing in those. The incommunicable ones are the ones that are unique to God alone. Infinity, for example. Omniscience. Omnipresence. We're never going to become omnipresent. We're never going to become omniscient. None of those things. But we can become loving. So we've kind of divided the attributes into two qualities, two big categories that help us understand God. There are some ways where God is what we call transcendent. He is completely other from us. It doesn't mean far away. It just means he's completely different, and he will never be like that. I'm never going to be omniscient. Okay? Jude likes to remind me of that. I'll walk into Jude's office sometimes, and I'll say, "Hey, Jude, I want you to do this for me." And she'll be writing, and she goes just like this. "Jude, I want you to do this for me." What that means is, here's Jim, here's the universe. It just makes me laugh. And so none of us are ever going to acquire that attribute. The communicable ones are the ones that we are. They communicate the immanence, the closeness of God to us. So God is very personal and immanent with us. He's in our lives. But he's also transcendent. He is completely other than. And so he has both sets of attributes, and they're personal attributes. He's described in terms of personal dynamics. So remember, we're answering the question, what is God like? He reconciles. So we can actually have a relationship with him because he reconciles us. So you picture, you know, you have a husband and wife, and they slowly are hating each other more and more, fighting and arguing. Pretty soon they're going to get divorced, and now they're estranged. Well, what has to happen for reconciliation to occur? This is kind of the picture presented by Paul in Romans, that they have to turn back to each other to reconcile. If only one turns back, the situation is reconcilable, but reconciliation has not occurred until they both turn. Okay. So at the cross, God's anger, it's called his wrath, I should say, not anger, his wrath, which is called propitiation. That's the technical term. His wrath is satisfied. So God has turned toward us through the cross, and now it's sitting on our shoulders. What are we going to do? Are we going to turn to God and be reconciled to him? That's why Paul says in 2 Corinthians, we have been reconciled, therefore we are ambassadors who have the ministry of reconciliation. We're bringing people to God. That's what we're attempting to do. Every human is reconcilable, but not every human is reconciled. So that's very personal language to define God. Another one is prayer. Prayer is a form of communication between people in a relationship. And so when we have a conversation, that is a form of communication like prayer. Prayer is communication with God. If he was a tree and wasn't real, we couldn't have communication with him. On my journey to Christ, I dated a girl who was a Christian all through high school. Her dad eventually led me to the Lord. But as I moved closer and closer and closer, when I got down to the very end, now I laugh at it. I'm sure God was hysterical up in heaven. I sat down in front of a tree and I prayed to the tree just to see what it felt like. You know? I prayed in front of a rock just to see. I grew up on the beach, so I couldn't pray in front of a mountain. I didn't have mountains. And so then I remember as I got to the very end, I sat down on the beach and I said, okay, God, if you're real, how could you have a conversation with somebody who's not real? It's just part of my journey, though, to be an idiot. So if you're real, then I'm going to commit my whole life to you. But you got to do the same. So I'm having these conversations hypothetically, if God was real. And now I look back on it, I just laugh my head off because I know he's like a father with a 2-year-old. Okay, whatever. Okay, whatever. And prayer is a very personal communication. You pray to a rock, and there's no communication. So all of the religions that I've seen that believe in some form of pantheism and polytheism, prayer isn't part of their relationship. They're not there to have a relationship with the gods. So in Hinduism, a rock can be a god, a tree can be a god, elephant can be a god. They're not there to have a personal relationship. They're there to simply appease the gods so that they leave us alone. They don't get ticked off at us. That's really what they're doing. But in Christianity, we believe in prayer. That's a personal form of communication with God. Love is another one, a reciprocal form of relating between two people. God is love. That right there, to me, is one of the most powerful arguments for the Trinity, because love requires two people. You can't love you by yourself. So there is obviously a time when God exists without us and without the creatures and the heavenlies. So how could God love if there wasn't at least another person? So I believe in the Trinity for that reason. That God knew love and experienced love long before he created anything. So when he created us to love each other and to know each other. Okay, what is God's mission? The last question. In other words, what does he do? The entire Bible from Genesis to Revelation unfolds the narrative of how God accomplishes his redemptive purposes for humanity. Namely, he desires all people to worship him alone as God. His plan is from all of eternity. His plan is of his own free choosing and will. His plan is ultimately about revealing his glory. His plan is all-inclusive. His plan is certain. And I have biblical verses if you want them for all this. In fact, in the class, if you want, I'll just give you all my notes here. His plan is certain. Okay? And part of his plan, which is a complex area to understand, is he made us as free moral agents to make choices. So here's how I define the gospel. The gospel is the story, the fantastic news of the one true living God who loves this entire creation so much that he'll do whatever it takes, short of violating our free will, to get us to turn to him. I'm not a Calvinist in that area. Okay? That's how I define it. I see God at work everywhere I look. Paul says in Romans 8, the animals, all of creation is awaiting his redemption, awaiting our redemption. I mean, you can picture the animals saying, come on, guys, get with the program. We can't be there until you're there. All of creation is awaiting his redemption, ultimate redemption. It started with us. That's why Jesus said we are the first fruits of creation to be redeemed. So a hermeneutic, that's a technical term for how to study the Bible and interpret it. I follow a missional or redemptive hermeneutic as the best way to explain the Bible, and it's simply put is this. Wherever you are in the Bible, God steps into that period of time with the cultural values of that period of time, and he lives with the cultural values so that he can begin to redeem them. He meets people where they are. In other words, that's true of all of your lives. When he saved you, he stepped right into your mess, whatever it was, and began the very slow journey of redeeming you. So he steps into history every time he speaks or acts and redeems, starts to redeem what's broken. So you have a period of time when rape was acceptable. Women were property and you're allowed to do that. So he steps into that and tolerates that, but begins to put in place principles of how to take care of women once they're raped, while he begins to address the questions of human dignity so that he can move culture away from rape. The Bible never says don't rape. It gives 13 passages on what to do when you rape a woman, but never says don't rape. That's because God didn't have to. He stepped in and said, all right, well, first of all, you can't, let's start dealing with human dignity. You can't address the rape question until you deal with human dignity first. And if culture doesn't believe in human dignity of women, you got a long ways to get that piece in place before it can fix the next piece. Okay? So throughout the class, we'll look at examples of this. So once he addresses that, then you move to the next period, and these things are now fixed. So there comes a point in time where rape's no longer allowed. And so now he starts messing with other areas of broken culture. And so the Bible is written over a long period of time, and it's the story of God stepping into period after period after period, fixing what's broken and redeeming it and moving on to the next one. When you get to the next one, this one's not the issue anymore, but now you have a new issue here. So that's why when you go back into the Old Testament, look at some of these passages, it thinks, man, we look an awful lot like a pretty horrible religion. Well, that's a horrible world back then. The good news is that you don't have to adopt the cultural values of any period of time in the Bible, because the assumption is that God is redeeming it and moving on beyond that. And so that's what the story communicates, is how that redemption occurs. So the Bible never says don't have slaves. Right? So how did our forefathers in the 18th and 19th centuries wrestle with that problem? They looked at that trajectory and they saw human dignity being put in place. You know, slaves, obey your masters. Masters, treat your slaves fairly. That's a human dignity command right there, redemptive command. There came a point in time when they said, you know, in Christ there is no slave or free man. We should do away with slavery. Now, if slavery were to come back, it wouldn't. But if it did, then those passages would still be redemptive for us. But because we don't have slavery, those passages are no longer redemptive. They're now a historical picture of what was happening at the time and how God intervened to address these very complex human dignity and human rights questions. That's what's called a redemptive hermeneutic. And that relates to an understanding of what is God's mission. His mission is to redeem creation, and he's doing it slowly over time. So what do we believe about God? Last statement, then we're done. This is what we find in our bylaws, our doctrinal statement. We believe in one God, the sovereign creator and sustainer of all things, morally perfect, eternally existent in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. There's our statement. One God. Any last thoughts or questions? A lot to think about, huh?
Yeah. It seems sort of funny that God's mission is to redeem creation when he created creation.
I know.
It seems sort of...
That's one of the great attributes of Christianity, that God created you, and the greatest way to show you human dignity is to give you the freedom to choose. That's one of the greatest ways we show dignity to others, is let them choose. Right? And God did that with us. We just chose the wrong way. So then, once we chose the wrong way, he said, all right, then I'm going to come redeem you. I'm going to pursue you, come after you. Never give up. You can choose to reject me. I'll give you that freedom. But I'm going to choose to follow, come after you, to lure you and win you over. When you look at it that way, God is more of a lover than he is a judge. So what did Jesus say? I did not come to condemn the world. John 3. Right? Pretty amazing language. So when he's with a woman caught in adultery, when he's with the Samaritan woman, when he's with Zacchaeus, when he's with the woman who washes his feet, right? He doesn't condemn them or confront them or anything for their sin. He begins to move toward them and love them, and they automatically respond by coming closer. He reserved his criticism for the leadership who had rejected him. That's where his criticism was. So his own modeling pictures the story of redemption in that he goes after people. So they're great pictures for us to remember how to love people that aren't like us. Very good. Next week? Next week is creation, right? Is that the next one?
Yep,
creation. Why is it important? Why does it matter? Are you a young earth, old earth? Don't care? See you next week.